Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number 5, we have Russia opening up a new GLONASS satellite tracking station in Nicaragua. This facility will be very important in improving the effectiveness of Russia's response to the U.S.'s GPS, but it's already being speculated by the U.S. that Moscow has much more nefarious intentions in mind than just upgrading commercial satellite technology. The Washington Post, the neoconservative outlet owned by billionaire mogul Jeff Bezos, wrote a full-length story full of innuendo and guesswork, which concludes with the impression that Russia's new facility is irresponsible and somehow a threat to regional peace in America's backyard. The authors try to frame it as though Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega is a Russian puppet, and that Russia's recent tank sale to the Central American country is a quid pro quo for them hosting this new super-secret spy base. That's not true, but they do go to creative lengths in twisting the truth into a contorted conspiracy theory. President Ortega did preside over Nicaragua during the 1980s, at which time the U.S. supported a group of rebels that are called the Contras against his rule. These fighters committed terrorist acts such as massacres and kidnappings, though just like their Syrian counterparts decades later, they're still held up as the epitome of democracy in the eyes of the American deep state. Despite being smeared as a dictator for roughly a decade, President Ortega did what no so-called dictator would do, and that stepped down in 1990 after he lost a bid for re-election. Not exactly what a supposed Russian puppet would do, right? And then we have the fact that he was re-elected 16 years later in 2006, and has been in office ever since. Again, that's not characteristic for a dictator, but an actual Democrat. Now the U.S. wants everyone to believe that there's some sort of secret military spy deal between Russia and Nicaragua just because relations between the two are returning to their Soviet-era closeness. It's Moscow's renewed focus in Western Hemispheric affairs which scares Washington, as the U.S. is very jealous about preserving its remaining influence in what it views as its backyard. Nicaragua is the latest target of the U.S.'s info-war operations in this region because of the aforementioned GLONASS and tank deals with Russia, but also because of the canal that a private Chinese company plans to build through the Isthmus to compete with the Panama Canal. Nicaragua, the hemisphere's second poorest country after Haiti, doesn't pose a threat to anyone, and is only acquiring the tanks and flexing its diplomatic muscles and engaging with the multipolar gray powers in order to protect its projects, and therefore safeguard the much-needed economic development that is poised to receive in the coming future. It's hard to predict what will happen next in today's chaotic world, but from the perspective of the American deep state, the destabilization of Nicaragua would serve their grand strategic interests by undermining Russia and China by extent, and preserving the U.S.'s hegemony in Central America, which is why the latest infowar attack against the country should be seen not as a one-off propaganda piece, but potentially as part of a larger preconditioning plan in advance of something larger. The next one up is palace intrigue in Trump's White House between Bannon and Kushner. Somewhat overshadowed by Trump's Syria strike and the false flag run up to it, a flurry of reports hit the mainstream media over the past couple of weeks about the fierce feud between the president's chief strategist and his son-in-law. Bannon comes from Breitbart and is described as a nationalist, while Kushner is a real estate exec and is seen by his critics as a globalist. These two contradictory ideological strands were bound to eventually clash, especially given that they previously enjoyed near equal access to the U.S.'s chief decision maker. If we syncretize most of the latest reports and filter out the obvious disinformation, we can gather that Bannon and Kushner were at each other's throats until recently, and that their rivalry might have been the hidden reason why Bannon was removed from his post in the National Security Council, though allowed to retain his top secret clearance privileges and permitted to occasionally sit in on some meetings, perhaps as a compromise. Bannon's official account about this event differs, and he and his Breitbart camp insist that he was only on the council in the first place in order to de-operationalize what Susan Rice had previously instituted in this major deep state organization. But it could also be, as other reports suggest, that Bannon is losing favor to Kushner. The narrative is convincing enough. Kushner has professionally followed in Trump's real estate mogul footsteps, and he's also married to his daughter, who is popularly thought to be his favorite child. In any Bannon-Kushner dispute, Trump might naturally be inclined to side with Kushner, who he's known for years already, than Bannon, who he hasn't even worked with for less than a year. Blood is thicker than water, as the saying goes. But sometimes, listening to the advice of in-laws isn't always the best thing to do. If Trump too overly sides with Kushner over Bannon and perpetuates the perception that his son-in-law is more influential than his own chief strategist, then it could lead to a revolt among Trump's Breitbart base, such as the one which seems to have mildly started due to his missile strike against Syria. It's still too early to assess the long-term political damage that this might have done for Trump's approval ratings among his previously most loyal constituents. But empirical evidence, as gleaned from the comments section on just about every Breitbart news article on this topic, suggests that his base is resoundingly against the president's attack on the Syrian Arab Army. Some people believe that the timing of Bannon's demotion from the National Security Council and the strikes that Trump carried out shortly thereafter isn't coincidental, and that it was only by sidelining Bannon that Kushner was able to convince the president to bomb Syria. If that theory is true, then it implies that Trump will be less likely to resist Kushner's neocon globalist agenda. And that means that a cruise missile strike might be the least of the world's worries in the coming future. Third on the countdown is the historic agreement between China and Myanmar to launch a long-delayed pipeline connecting the southern Chinese province of Yunnan to the Indian Ocean. Roughly a decade after the deal was first agreed to in principle and coming 2 years following the pipeline's physical completion, the two sides have reached an understanding which will allow oil to finally flow across this path. Technical disagreements and geopolitical jostling by Myanmar in trying to play off the U.S. and China in recent years were responsible for the delay, but now it seems like Naypyidaw has finally realized that it's to the country's grand strategic benefit to pragmatically cooperate with Beijing. The soon-to-be-inaugurated pipeline will therefore be a major game-changer for China's geopolitics, as it will allow the People's Republic to import oil alongside the gas which is already transiting this route, and therefore avoid the Strait of Malacca bottleneck and contentious waters of the South China Sea. Basically, Myanmar is China's detour for energy imports from the Mideast and East Africa. And this new energy Silk Road will diminish the strategic purpose of the U.S.'s naval capabilities in those two formerly mentioned bodies of water, at least as it relates to controlling China's energy access. Myanmar is expected to greatly benefit from this because it will naturally become a closer and more strategic partner to China, thereby endowing it with the resultant economic advantages that such a friendship usually brings. The Kiakfu to Kunming pipeline route could also one day be expanded to include a high-speed railroad in facilitating commercial transactions, though that's still a ways off for the time being. In the meantime, however, Myanmar can somewhat complement Pakistan vis-a-vis China's grand strategy in providing it with direct and reliable access to the Indian Ocean, through which most of China's energy and trade traverses. It can't be overstated just how important this is for the emerging multipolar world order, though consequently, it's also going to entail a fair share of hybrid war vulnerabilities in the coming future. This is because the U.S. is naturally opposed to any sort of development, such as this one, which is poised to improve China or its other Eurasian great powers' strategic position at the relative expense of the U.S.'s own. Accordingly, the most cost-effective and concept-proven way to disrupt, control, or influence multipolar transnational connective infrastructure projects such as this one is through hybrid war, which is externally provoked identity conflict in geostrategic transit states such as Myanmar. In English, this means that the U.S. might encourage various elements in Myanmar's multi-sided civil war to prolong their hostilities and de facto freeze their participation in the Panglong 2.0 federalization peace talks. In addition, the Bengali Muslim insurgency of the so-called Rohingya population in the northern part of Rakhine State might also intensify, especially seeing as how they inhabit the same state which serves as the terminal point for China's pipeline. I don't have a crystal ball in front of me, but common sense tells me that the U.S. isn't too happy that this deal is finally going forward after having been deadlocked for a decade, and that Washington might resort to clandestine action to subvert the major strategic benefits that its Chinese rival is slated to receive. Our runner-up is the horrible Palm Sunday massacre which targeted Egypt's Coptic Christian community. Daesh carried out this horrific attack, which consisted of two suicide bombings targeting Coptic Christian church services on the holy day of Palm Sunday and killing at least 45 people. Scores more were injured, and the government immediately declared a 3-month state of emergency in response to this terrible act of terrorism. This isn't the first time that Egypt has been targeted by Daesh, nor the first time that Christians have been slaughtered either. But the contemporary context in which this occurs is very unsettling. Daesh is being pushed back in Libya and Syria, which are respectively to Egypt's west and east. And now it seems like members of this group, whether trained in those battlefields or inspired by those who might be fighting there, are rising up in the middle ground between those two wannabe caliphates and setting their sights on the world's most populated Arab nation. Furthermore, there are close ideological and militant parallels between the Muslim Brotherhood and Daesh, and there's a chance that members of one group might freely mingle or associate with the other due to their many commonalities, not least of which is their shared interest in violently overthrowing the secular government and installing a Salafist system. Christians are hated by Daesh and aren't held in high regard by the Muslim Brotherhood either, which makes them a very tempting soft and symbolic target for terrorism. Last Sunday's attacks were meant to instill a deep sense of fear within this community, to terrorize them in every sense of the word, and to also send a strong message to the government that Daesh is capable of striking in the most audacious manner possible and undercutting the authorities' legitimacy in protecting minorities. Cairo recognizes the severity of this threat, and that's why President Sisi implemented the 3-month state of emergency in order to grant the government a freer hand in dealing with it. Nevertheless, Egypt now finds itself once more under a system of limited military rule, which will undoubtedly feed criticism abroad and further the false narrative that President Sisi is a dictator, likely drawing on comparisons with Mubarak, who famously had a decades-long state of emergency in place. The point behind such information provocations would be to encourage what might be portrayed as a democratic uprising against them, but in reality would be nothing more than a redo of the violent Arab Spring color revolution. Someone doesn't like Sisi, and it's not because he's on chummy terms with the U.S. again or has been patronized to the tunes of billions of dollars of aid from the Gulf Kingdom, but because of his flourishing relationships with Russia and China, the two Eurasian great powers which serve as the engines of the emerging multipolar world order. At our top spot, we've got the game-changing implications of Trump's audacious cruise missile strike against Syria. Alright, we all know what happened. Trump bombed Syria on the fake pretext of responding to a false flag chemical weapons attack. So I'm not going to review what we're already aware of. Instead, I want to take a different angle and talk about the strategic consequences of what he did. First off, we can't avoid the fact that Russia did not shoot down the cruise missiles, much to the furious consternation of alt-media neocons who are braying for blood in World War III. This approach, which I mockingly refer to as non-Russian pro-Russians being more Russian than the Russians, is absolutely uncalled for. But it's taken social media by storm in representing a populist reaction to what Russia should have done, apparently. In debunking this false narrative, we need to accept the fact that, yes, it's a fact, for better or for worse, hate it or love it, and one which is often officially repeated, that the Russian military mandate in Syria is strictly limited solely to anti-terrorist operations and does not include the protection of the Syrian Arab Army or the country's borders. This explains, for example, why Israeli jets occasionally bomb Syria but aren't shot down by Russia's S-400 state-of-the-art anti-air systems. The implication of this, however, has been that Trump realized that he can exploit this technicality to his advantage in unprecedentedly striking the Syrian Arab Army, which instantly put an end to any false perceptions the global public might have had about the scope of Russia's military mandate. First Deputy Chairman of the Federation Council's Committee on International Affairs, Vladimir Jabarov, remarked a few days after the event that, quote, Russia has no intentions to use its aerospace forces against U.S. missiles if Washington decides to carry out new strikes in Syria, as it could lead to a large-scale war, end quote, signaling that the apocalyptic scenario of World War III that the so-called super patriots have been praying for won't come anytime in the future if Trump carries through on launching more strikes. And about that, the American president might actually carry through on his word and commence more bombings of the Syrian Arab Army on the fraudulent pretext of punishing President Assad for supposed human rights violations, though in reality just trying to reverse the anti-terrorist gains that Moscow and Damascus have achieved in the past year and a half. As part of that, the U.S. has an eye on shifting the on-the-ground military balance in such a way as to squeeze political administrative concessions from the Syrian authorities, such as the de facto internal partition of their country through federalization. Raising the stakes, President Putin called the Idlib event a false flag and warned earlier this week that many more might be in the works all across Syria. which if we connect two and two together and link Trump's threat to order more bombings with Russia's signal that it won't shoot down any cruise missiles, we can logically infer that the U.S.'s direct military involvement in Syria might only intensify in the coming future, though thankfully stopping short of World War III unless the U.S. targets Russian forces, which is not likely. These new dynamics can naturally have game-changing implications in influencing the future course of the war on Syria, and more broadly, the rest of the Mideast and Afro-Eurasia in general, though it's difficult to say for sure at this point which way they might be headed. What we do know, however, is that Trump's strike opened up a Pandora's box of dangerous military possibilities, and that none of this augurs well for the prospects of peace in Syria. All right, folks, well, there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for listening to my program. Next week, I'll be on vacation, so we'll recommence the weekend of April 28th. Thank you, and hope you tune in again then. Bye.